Now, this is the Gaming Regulatory Oversight Authority meeting on, in which we're conducting a public hearing to gather testimony, reports from people on basically on our mission. I do want to say that there are slips there for you, those who wish to actually testify. They're on the table in front of me. I ask that you fill that out if you are going to testify and send it down the line to me. And we also have a clipboard sign-in sheet. I suppose it duplicates to some extent, but I would appreciate particularly those who are testifying signing that. And to go back to the purpose of this session, it is to hear testimony on our mission. We're trying to get as much help as we can as we go forward with this endeavor. I think if anybody looks closely at it, they'll agree it's a very complex undertaking, a challenging undertaking with a brief window in which we're allowed to do our work. So we're committed to do it within that time frame. We want to get as much information as we can from all sources, all perspectives. That's the purpose of this hearing, to help us move down that road. And I just wanted to refer to the statute that has established us. It's RSA 284-A. It was amended at the end of this regular session in June. And as amended, it has three essential commands to this authority. The overarching command is that in our work, we undertake to ensure integrity and public confidence in gaming regulation. Very simple. So integrity and public confidence. And the second part of this mandate is that we oversee and assess the current regulation of gaming activities authorized pursuant to New Hampshire law. So we need to look at what is today. And thirdly, to recommend the appropriate regulation of casino gambling in New Hampshire. So we're also commanded to look ahead and think about the possible expansion of casino gambling. A few other parts of the statute that I wanted to reference, more specifically, the statute tells us to evaluate whether the current regulations and regulatory bodies for legal gaming in the state are adequate to operate in a manner that protects the public interest and allows the regulation of gaming to be conducted in an effective and efficient manner. So again, that piece is about current gaming authorization and how it's doing. The second is to design that these are subsets of that umbrella set of commands that I went over to start with. The second is to design the structure of the oversight agency necessary to regulate all lawful gaming and betting activity in the state, considering whether the state should continue the current divided structure or whether the state should adopt a unified and centralized gaming control authority. So that piece relates both to the current situation and to the uncharted future. We need to look at gaming structure in both contexts. The third command is, as a subset of the broader command, is that we review legislative proposals. We take that to mean the 2013 legislative proposals and recommend comprehensive statutory and regulatory provisions to enable and oversee casino gaming. Then we are asked to identify and draft. So we need to go beyond review and all the other things that I've gone over, but actually identify and draft appropriate laws and regulations for ensuring ongoing and stringent review and enforcement of current and proposed gaming operations. And then there's a number of subsets to that part of the command, including a process for sustaining ongoing charitable gaming resources to charities in New Hampshire. At the end of the statute, it tells us that we have to get this done by December 15th of this year. We are code to draft legislation with supporting regulations and a report to the general court by that date. So that's what we're out to do. Perhaps some of you who are coming up to testify want to tell us why gaming is good or gaming is bad. That's really not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the regulatory structure, not the good or the bad. And I do ask, as you testify, there are quite a number, but I think it's very manageable, that you try to confine your testimony to those points, and also that you don't take too much time in deference to all the other people who want to testify. Anything else that the members of the authority want to add to that general overview? All right. I have a number of slips here. I'd like to actually start with the two legislators who have other, unless you tell me you can wait, but Catherine Rogers has told me that she has another appointment. Representative Rogers, you've given us a printed form of your testimony, but I'm sure you have a few words to add.
And thank you all for letting me talk to you again. I was very happy to see this bill.
Okay, you have to speak up as much as you can for the sake of the audience.
As Representative Hanks said, I've given you written testimony so that you see what I'm talking about and move on. Last week when we spoke to you about the Omnibus Amendment, some of you asked questions about regulations, and I don't think I answered too completely, which is why I asked to speak to you quickly today. As a member of the Joint Committee that looked at Senate Bill 152, casino legislation, this last session, I had a chance to look at regulations not only in New Hampshire, but in other states around the country that have similar casinos. I actually served on the subcommittee that dealt specifically with regulations. So I'm not by any means an expert, but I have had a chance to look at a number of them. As a result of doing that, I strongly believe that the New Hampshire Lottery Commission is the place that should be home to any new casino that happens to come forward. Some people have argued that the casino would not be best served by having the lottery do it, since the lottery is charged to, is set up only to promote and purchase lottery tickets, to encourage gambling in order to meet certain revenue projections, and as such, won't be able to police or enforce the casino. I would disagree with that. History, I think, is our best guide. Our lottery commission, which is the first in the country, has been in existence for over 50 years, has never had any scandal or any questionable behavior. I think that we look at that, and that gives us a basis for knowing the kind of people, to not this specific executive director, no offense, Mr. McIntyre, I think you're great, but it's not specifically him. I think that that commission has over time proven its integrity and the public confidence that people have in it. So I think that it's got a basis to go. Additionally, the lottery uses advanced technology to track games of chance, and it accurately regulates revenue on a daily basis in the operations. They have track record. Their core mission, if we ask them to build, to work with building the casino, will be to regulate the casino, just as they regulate the lottery now. I don't think that it's saying that they can't have separate divisions, such as our state police have many divisions. Our Justice Department has many divisions within the Attorney General's office. A number of our departments have divisions that work to encompass a large, broad space. I think that the Lottery Commission can do the same thing. Some members of the legislature had expressed concern that the Lottery Commission is run by three part-time volunteers as commissioners. I think if you look at a number of our departments in the state, a lot of them are overseen by a part-time commission. But you must remember, our Lottery Commission has a number of full-time, very experienced, very professional staff. And as I said, again, it's not just the current executive director, who we're all very pleased with. And we're not saying it's just him. Over 50 years, they have had staff that has done this job, that has regulated and promoted and provided revenues. Quite often, more revenues than we expect, with no scandal and no questions of behavior. So I think that those are arguments that we have to look at. The last thing I guess I would mention to you is that, or two things. One, this commission, I think, has an important role. It's an oversight authority. I think keeping this in existence to oversee any new operation that might come in the case of a casino, and look back over the course of a year or 2 years and say, well, we need to tweak this, or we need to change the way this is done. A group of people such as yourself that are diverse in nature, that cover various areas of the spectrum that would be involved with gaming, would be a good one to look back after a year's time and say, well, if we have it with the Lottery Commission, we should expand this division or we should do this. One thing we know as legislators is every 2 years we look at our budget and we re-examine. This year we gave more people to the Department of Revenue Administration because they needed help in collecting the taxes and doing the audit. Each year we look at how we need to tweak or look at whatever department is running it. So I think that this authority could be important in doing that job. And then lastly, I would just throw up that maybe what we need to do, instead of building a whole new bureaucracy to run a gaming casino facility, is look at combining those agencies that now exist, you know, the lottery, the charitable and gaming, whatever else it should go in to under the lottery, or combine them all together and make it less duplicative. But I think building a new bureaucracy, a new agency, with no institutional experience is not the way to go. I would suggest, after my short view of it and the short time looking at it, the Lottery Commission would be the place to help. And thank you very much.
Questions? I have a question.
Okay.
Those other states that you looked at, can you fill that out a little bit?
Well, I think that some of the things that the regulatory committee, we looked at other states, we looked at Connecticut, we looked at Michigan, we looked at Pennsylvania. I did a great deal of work in drafting language of the Omnibus Amendment, specifically on political contributions and on the crimes of gambling. So in the course of doing that, I looked at the statutes probably most aggressively, New Jersey, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut. I tried to look at all the other states that did it. Those are the ones that I spent the most time examining, however.
And did you look at the structure, the bureaucratic structure?
I tried to look at all of it, you know, as I said, in the course of my charge on that committee to look at the regulations, I tried to look at them, and as I said, all the other 30 states, those states that I mentioned are the ones that I looked at a little more closely. I think every state has it a little different. There's no uniform pattern of how to do it. And one thing in New Hampshire we pride ourselves on is we do things differently. Sometimes I would argue I don't like the way we do them differently, but other times I do, and I think we found that it works. And I guess my thought is, all of these other groups I looked at in other states, their statutes were not as old as our lottery. Our lottery was the first 50 years of experience in regulating gaming, in providing revenue for the state, and no scandal. And those three things, to me, were very important and proof of we're doing something right.
Good. Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you so much.
And thank you for letting me go first.
The only other representative I have here is Bill Butinsky. Would you like to go now, or you like to wait?
I can wait, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any others that need to go, you know, go up front? I have two individuals here I know who have traveled some distance and who have a lot of expertise, I'm told, and I'd like to call them now so that they can go on about their business. And that would be Patrick Moore and Rich LaBroca. Morning.
All right. My name is Patrick Moore.
And again, I just ask you to speak up.
Yes, sir.
I don't know whether you switch. Try turning it on.
It's on.
It's on. How about that? Okay.
All right.
Go for it. Oh.
Could I ask that the gentleman also spell their name so we can get them down?
Yes. Yes. Please do that.
It's P-A-T-R-I-C-K, Patrick, and Moore, M-O-O-R-E. Rich, R-I-C-H, L-A-B-R-O-C-C-A.
Thank you very much.
And you are representing, come from?
We represent Gaming Laboratories International. Patrick is the Senior Director of Compliance, and I am the Senior Director of Engineering.
So GLI is an independent test laboratory that works for state tribal governments to actually confirm and verify and ultimately certify the products that go into the markets. We've been in business since 1989. We currently work with 450 jurisdictions around the world. And
how many?
We are
450.
That's
a lot.
So where, I guess where GLI has kind of found their niche in the market is the, you know, the idea that, you know, gaming is built on the backbone of technology. And I say gaming, you know, lottery, you know, kind of mean that those terms are universally, but it's really built on the backbone of technology. And as we know, technology advances very quickly. And what these regulators have done is they've chosen to outsource what is a critical regulatory function to a company like GLI. It allows us to keep pace with that technology, employ really the best and brightest in the fields of mathematics, computer science, computer engineering, and really give them sort of the best level of review and certification possible. And so where, I guess what we came here today is we've been monitoring, as we do with every state, really that's emerging and that's involved in gaming. We're very familiar with SB 152, and we never take a position on bills. So we're always a very neutral, independent agency, but we understand that we reside in a very unique vantage point within the industry, where we end up becoming sort of the center spoke of these hundreds of regulatory agencies that are plugged into to our certification services. So we get a chance to see what works, what doesn't work, who does what well, and we have been a part of every major, really every video lottery system installation that's taken place in the United States. And so that's given us, again, a really unique perspective, and we're really here to share that with you and try to answer any questions that you may have of, you know, a general technical nature, the types of control that the systems would allow you to have as the regulator, the type of information, and really what you'll find as you go into this is that the technologies really can be tailored. And so, you know, you really have to figure out as a regulator what your risk profile is, or what your level of aversion to risk is, and what your level of control, desired control is. And so, it really runs the gamut within our country of the level of control that regulators have, when employing a central system, or really just when regulating gaming. So some of them fully operate the systems themselves. They ramp up staff, and they staff it, and they get people trained, and they have a whole operations center that falls totally under the regulator. And they do all of the day-to-day operation. And then the other side of that spectrum would be regulators who take the approach where they hire a qualified operator who operates the system, and is obviously licensed in background, and ends up being a trusted operator, and really part of an extension of the lottery, but already has all of that knowledge embedded. And in those cases, the lottery then takes more of an audit role. And so they'll come in and they'll do periodic audits, and they'll require certain things like reports, things like that are sent at certain intervals. And obviously, what you can see in those two two structures is in this case, obviously you're going to look at a structure that's more robust as far as overall size, capability, job creation, those types of things. But if the goal is to have something that is sleeker and smaller, and is clearly less expensive as far as budget-wise, then this side of the spectrum is what you would see within those various markets. And so, and what I would say too is that the technology is the technology is what we do, so we get excited about it. But it's interesting to see how the technology is actually allowing regulators to really be more effective at achieving the regulatory objectives, but doing it in a way that's more efficient than could have ever been imagined. So one great example of this is within Senate Bill 152. This obviously talks importantly about player protection and informed players, and making sure that you're notifying players of when they may be playing too much. Some of the systems, the newer protocols that they're using, the actual communication protocols that are being used, actually support the ability for the system, which is always linked to the games, to actually kind of take over parts of the game, almost like if you have a TV and you have a picture-in-picture, you know, where you can bring up another channel here in the corner, and then you're playing on the primary display here, and you can actually send messages like that to the player. You can send a little short video clip, informative about you know, where they can call if they feel like they have a gambling problem. And so these are all things that the technology is really fostering. And which is so much different than maybe back in the day if it was a pamphlet or you know, some other type of mechanism that just may not be as effective. So in the technology itself, from a monitoring control standpoint, it's really dramatic. And you may not see anything like it within the state as far as the level of monitoring. You know, the games are sort of almost, think of it as each game almost having a security system attached to it. And so the idea that a door opens and an instant event is sent to the system. There's some sub-door or it's lost power. You know, it's constantly being monitored by the system in a way for activity, dollars in, dollars out, accounting. And that system, you know, as envisioned originally within SB-152, is, you know, it's an independent system held by, you know, by the regulator. And so there's no ability to manipulate that data, and it's completely locked down. So, you know, I think as you move forward in this effort, you know, you're really going to see, I think, that while it maybe feels like, you know, New Hampshire is, maybe behind the other states in their review or their investigation of gaming, that's not always a bad thing. And the gaming industry is heavily regulated naturally, so we always see newer technology about 5 years later than, you know, really the public sector. But it's not bad to sort of be late to the game, if you will, because you get the benefit of the best technology you can possibly employ at the time, which, you know, some jurisdictions at this point didn't have that benefit. Maybe they need a large expenditure on something that's just not as sophisticated as it's available today.
I'd just like to add, I've been a part of nearly every lottery install in the United States, as well as many typical commercial casino installs and probably install back end in large computer systems that are doing this control of these systems. And everything that I've ever worked in, all have a very unique regulatory structure. They all work well for that particular state's needs, but they all have moved from a more manual, large enforcement position to a more technically supported position. I can remember when I first started in this industry 16 years ago, largely people went out to a machine and physically used evidence tape to secure a machine. Today that doesn't happen nearly as much anymore. They rely on largely remote aspects of central systems. So the fact that you're looking at this regulatory structure as a whole definitely needs to be considered, that technology will help you dictate the scope of how big that overall structure needs to be. And if anyone has a question about a particular implementation out there, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
So I just want to make sure you folks are focused on either lotteries or real lottery machines in casinos, which is one element of regulation that we need to think about. And then there's other stuff that casinos do, table games and so forth and so on, which is, you know, more manual, at least connected, like the lottery is, or like video lottery machines are, to technology. Do I have that right? There's sort of two areas of regulation that we have to be thinking about.
Generally, table games are regulated separately than an electronic gaming device, whether it be a VLT or a slot machine. That said, technology today allows you to bridge that gap. Most of the tables we're seeing now are somehow supported in the tracking of the revenues being placed across them, whether it be RFID-enabled chips where the table is smart enough to read a signal in the chip to track it, or whether it be a dealer-assisted type model where the dealer is doing input periodically as the game is taking place. Those are definitely something we deal with on a daily basis, and it goes even further than that to completely automated table games where you have no dealers and they're completely virtualized, the table games as well. There is not a significant amount to test on the traditional belt and card table games, but we do offer for several jurisdictions, actually, complete math analysis. This is, I think, examination of the strategy of that particular game and whether or not it's going to yield the expected return on both sides, to the player and to the operator, as far as the proposed scheme in question.
And what you'll see as well is on the same game side, what a number of jurisdictions do is you'll ultimately probably come up with a list of authorized skills, you know, the types of games are blackjack and possibly roulette and other games. And what you'll see is you'll see a, you know, developers are very creative and you'll see a lot of variants for those games. And what certain jurisdictions have done is they've asked for really, it's really a fusion of a technical and a legal opinion to say that, hey, here's a new game that they're saying is really a slight variant to one of our authorized games. Is that true? Or have they fundamentally changed it by adding these additional bets and these additional sequences to the point where your commission may have to meet again to now rule whether or not this game needs to be added to the authorized game list or if it can come in as an approved variant. And I would also offer too that you know, our the position that our company is in the industry also gives us the availability of, you know, we can put you in the right direction if you come and say, hey, like, what's a good model for the regulation standpoints, and who seems to do it well, who's got robust regulations, and it's really just pointing in the direction of, hey, it's this commission, and you'll really see too that commissions are usually pretty open about helping other emerging markets and other emerging commissions, and especially if you know, you're able to go to them and say, hey, we've heard that you've got really robust regulations here and that you're really sort of known for being good at this, would you mind helping us? And they're usually very open to that, and I think we can help at least point you in the right direction.
Yes.
Your last comment actually sort of forecast what my question to you was going to be, and that is, if you were to name two jurisdictions that you consider to be the most robust or the best in terms of their regulatory system, who would you say?
I'll tell you what, that's really tough. It's such a subjective thing, mm-hmm. and I think that each, you know, what we've seen is each market really has their own objectives, mm-hmm. and really their own motivations for whether doing some job creation, some it's purely revenue. So it's really challenging for us to say that, especially in the fact that we're so focused on the technology piece. Mm-hmm. So if I could tell you places that have reams and reams of regulations, but they may not necessarily be efficient and effective for the marketplace. And then obviously everything that's really happened in the gaming industry in the last few years has really whitewashed a lot of the, you can't just look at revenue figures and say, well, they're doing a great job. So it's hard for me to give you an overall answer, mm-hmm. but if we really focus down to certain components, whether it be table games or the technology itself or the central system, I think we could do a really good job of giving you saying, hey, for this piece, they've done a really good job here, and that ends up being replicated, hopefully. Because standardization is important too in the industry. It's good to be different and meet your objectives, but when it comes to really the technologies and the things that you want to get in, standardization is important. You want to make sure you're up to that standard, and that also your properties aren't having to have everything developed, absolutely custom to where they're paying this exorbitant fee for the equipment that's coming in, and therefore makes them less profitable, and then therefore there's less tax revenue overall.
My second question is sort of a follow-up to General Foster, is how much of a switch are you seeing from the manual table games to the virtual table games?
I'll tell you what, it's pretty dramatic, but when you're talking about a span of 450 jurisdictions, you really see the entire gamut. So you have some that are very sensitive that, hey, look, we're about job creation, and dealers are jobs, and we're not going to mess with that. If there's things that make them more efficient, great, but we don't want to replace the dealer. In other places, they don't have those same considerations, and so they're saying, hey, we can save a lot of money by not having dealers. Let's go fully automated. But I would say that the balance that you're getting, and it's probably a great parallel to what you're trying to do here on the system side, is that a manual table game is very manual, right? The money transactions, even giving people their promotional points, the pit boss sort of looks back and is kind of guessing, what they bet at this point, and Whereas the mechanisms that have been added to these tables, the electronic mechanisms, have the ability to make the accounting very clean. You know, maybe they're going into, through bill validators now, but they're still using physical cards. Or you're not able to, maybe the dealer's still taking transactions, but the actual gameplay is now controlled by computers, so there's no missteals, there's no collusion. There's things like that where the technology's creeping in to clean up things that maybe haven't been, you know, completely accurate the entire time.
Thank you.
Are you doing business in New Hampshire with anybody right now?
No.
We've done some work for your lottery
in the past.
In the form of random number generator analysis, which is a fancy way of saying some advanced math to prove some drawing tools work for you.
Yeah, I think 2007 was the last submission we had. And so we do an independent mathematical evaluation of the RNGs that would be used for the quick picks and things like that.
I have a question. Sure. The compulsive gambling video, is that rendered to the player based off of some formula? Is it based off of if you interpret that the player hasn't moved for so many hours, that you send a video like that, or is that based off jurisdiction?
It's really driven by a number of parameters that you can specify, yeah, and the system will support. The protocol supports the ability to render the video or a text message or a number of other things. How you set that up to fire can be based on time, maybe after a one-hour session. It could also be set up to be based on how much money a person may have committed to wager. A lot of the European markets do it on a periodic basis. Several of the domestic markets do it on a number of dollars wagered, or in some cases dollars won, but mostly dollars wagered. You get to decide that parameter, and the system provider will build it this mechanism.
In your estimation, if I follow up the question,
yes, please.
Entirely different question. Is it easier to regulate a closed system than an open system? Can you explain what that means to the members of the authority?
I assume you mean by an open versus closed system, in that it's completely locked by one agency?
Correct.
Do you mean?
Right. The reason I ask that is the lottery is an open system, right? The end user isn't at our control largely, but the slot machine, by and large, is for the most part. It's we alpha to the omega. Do you find that easier, and is that helpful? The members.
I believe it's probably quicker with a closed system, but with the right controls, an open system is equally effective. But you have to have that built in before you even take your first step. Otherwise, you wind up having to do significantly more manual work to potentially find an issue should an issue occur. The systems, as Patrick mentioned, provide you the ability for security and notifications and revenue tracking. One of the really most important things that's often overlooked is it provides you or your independent contractor or potentially an investigator the ability to audit every transaction, to go backwards and find here is what happened when a particular item of interest had happened. That's really the key strength in a centralized system. It's great to have the real-time reporting, the real-time events, but what you really look at is my ability to go backwards and say, we had an incident, what happened, I need a full picture so I can make a full, fair, and balanced decision going forward. And that is really what you have to spec into your system to make sure that you can do your business going forward in a manner that allows you to go backwards.
Yeah, and I would add that in an open system, you may be offsetting some of the responsibility for maybe archiving of records, things like that for your auditors, whereas in a closed system, you have full responsibility of the data that's coming in, what gets archived, what doesn't get archived, for how long. And so in an open system, you may be offsetting some of that, and you'll have controls for that, and you'll have rules for that, but the actual responsibility gets offset somewhat to where, you know, you don't have necessarily full control. If someone can make a mistake, or and then you've lost some key information.
Just a broad question, then we need to wrap this part of it up. this may be too broad. Can you tell us of any pitfalls that we should be looking out for as we think about overall regulatory structure or content?
The regulatory, one of the pitfalls that I have encountered in my career is when you have opposing regulatory structures who have separated responsibilities in such a way that they have different goals for the technology that's being used. Again, our focus is primarily technology, where one entity may have the enforcement and the other may have the revenue collection. Those are two very different things. And what I see is, rather than coming to the table with a clear and concise picture, they come to the table with opposing views. And that generally has caused not necessarily an end result problem, but a delay in getting to the goal. And it takes a long time to bring parties together to understand and develop a system that will meet both of their needs. So one of the things that I would recommend to this committee is understand what your goals are going to be as a collective group of people, and then divide those responsibilities if you see fit to divide those responsibilities. Because the adversarial nature of providing alternate technical specifications to a third party who's going to build this computer is really going to make it difficult for them to give you a system that is going to work for you. And what you wind up having happen is they deliver a product they think you asked for, and it turns out that one or more parties is unsatisfied with the end result. Not that that system is incapable of operating in a good regulatory matter, it just doesn't happen to meet your expectations because you had competing expectations.
That's helpful. Thank you. We all set here. So thank you so much for coming. And, it's been very informative. Okay, I've got Jamie Timbus. You in the room? Jamie Timbus? It's all right. He'll be back. I'll put him down to the bottom. Ed Callahan?
Game operator, employer, and primary game operator in the conduct of charitable gaming at Rockingham Park in Seabrook. I think currently the state of New Hampshire has some tremendous assets along the lines of gaming. I think the Lottery Commission, who we've dealt with since 1983, sales of lottery tickets, the operation of sweepstakes races, and they had regulated bingo and lucky sevens for a number of years. And the Racing and Charitable Gaming Commission, which currently regulates bingo, lucky sevens, prior mutual wagering, and games of chance. I guess my personal belief is you should utilize all the assets that you currently have and build upon them. I do not believe that either of these commissions have the capability of governing all of the gaming that may take place within the state, and that some type of combination with additions, and particularly additions of specifically talented individuals in the gaming industry, will ultimately provide you with the most efficient process in which to regulate this industry. There's an awful lot of commonalities between what's currently happening in charitable gaming and what may happen in the event of a proposed casino legislation to pass in whatever type of casino or slot parlor or whatever type of gaming the legislature ultimately decides would be appropriate for this state. And I think that you want whoever is governing a potential casino to be working somewhat along the same lines as whoever is governing the charitable gaming that takes place. Charitable gaming currently has table games, probably the most difficult portion of a casino facility to regulate. And they have considerable experience and expertise in that at this point. At the same time, as the two gentlemen before me, technology is expanding rapidly in that industry. The potential that table games can be operated with RFID chips and the ability to track basically every transaction that occurs is a very long reach from where we were 5-10 years ago in the table game industry. No one in New Hampshire currently is utilizing this technology because it's rather expensive. But it's available out there and in an appropriate commercial facility that should be something that is capable of being done. Your typical slot machines, your video lottery machines, any of your electronic gaming, I think is very easily tied into a central system. Ultimately, it depends on the requirements the state or the regulatory body has in regulating those machines, but it's been done. It's easy. Ultimately, you can, whether you talk with GLI or whether you talk with any of a dozen other companies out there who are involved in that process, I think it's very easy to see what is capable of being accomplished. And can provide you an extremely secure operation in conjunction with whoever your licensed operators are. But I do believe that you have an awful lot of talent existing in the state, and I think you should utilize that. I do not believe that creating a whole new branch is going to work well. As we've seen in Massachusetts, who passed legislation, I think it was 3 years ago now, is still having difficulty with their brand new commission that is trying to figure out exactly what they're doing. I know on the racing end, you have people who had never seen the inside of a racetrack before who are now regulating the racetracks in Massachusetts. On the casino end, again, you have some people who had never seen the inside of a casino until they were on that commission and have taken a number of trips since then, but I think you have a lot of that experience in-house, and I think you should utilize it. You should add to it, and hopefully you would add to it in a manner that would make the process reasonably efficient. Licensing, not only of a facility and the people who own or operate that facility is going to be a major issue, but then they will have the job of licensing some 1,500, 2,000, maybe 4,000 people who are going to work in that facility or in the multiple facilities that might be approved. That's a lengthy process. And the hope would be that that could be expedited when you ultimately get into the regulatory regulation process. There'd be plenty more I'd like to add, but I don't think you're quite ready for that. And my assumption would be, Mr. Chairman, that down the road there will be public input when you begin looking at the actual regulations of how these facilities would be regulated.
We're working through this step by step, so no promises.
Understood. But my hope would be to make additional comment at that point in time.
Appreciate that.
But I have been regulated by these commissions. And additional ones in the state. It wouldn't surprise me if I'm the most investigated individual in the state. And as much as I'm investigated for a liquor license, for a racing license, for a game operator employer license, for a bingo facility license, for a security license, So in the course of the year, I submit close to 9 background checks and 5 sets of fingerprints annually, along with tax returns and hundreds of pages of documentation on myself, my family, my parents, my aunts, my uncles, and so forth. And you have that expertise here. You need, I believe you need to utilize it in that.
Thank you. Questions? I really appreciate you coming in. That was very helpful. Okay, next in the pile is Jan DiMarzio.
Mr. Chairman, I'm with Jan. I'm at the same time.
Yes. So it's Michael McLaughlin and Jan DiMarzio.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Green Light, Michael McLaughlin, Attorney.
Just hold on a sec. Sorry to interrupt you.
Again, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Committee. My name is Michael McLaughlin, an attorney and lobbyist in Concord, New Hampshire. I represent the Community Bingo Center, as well as an entity called Hinsdale Harness LLC. Over the past 15 years, I've represented racetracks, machine manufacturers, bingo licensees, and have a pretty good idea of how the system operates. Jan is the manager of a commercial bingo hall in Manchester. She is here with me today to answer any questions on bingo that you might have. Bingo, as I've learned over the last several years, is absolutely nothing to do with what we used to think bingo was in the bottom of the church basement. It's a highly technical, highly skilled operation. The charitable bingo world in New Hampshire delivers about $13 million worth of revenue to charities. And to quote Hippocrates, I think the first thing the commission has to do is do no harm, and do no harm to the charities. And as I've been looking at the mandate for the commission, I think one of the things we miss a little bit is we all use the term lottery as if they are the end-all and be-all of gaming regulation. The Lottery Commission, as it's put together today, is strictly controlled on what they can do with their revenue under the New Hampshire Constitution. So when you start talking about dumping in a casino or dumping in charitable gaming, I think we're going to think about what we have to do to the lottery structure to make sure that we don't start pooling the expenses, the opportunities, and the monies of what they do. Because today, Director McIntyre gives every penny that he nets to the Education Trust Fund. So how do we then send him a whole group of new responsibilities, and where do we build the concrete walls between the lottery and the casino or the lottery and the charitable gaming? So as I look at the relationships that we've developed with the Racing Charitable Gaming Commission, there is a future. The future is charitable gaming. I'm working today with an entity that's going to get working for a live racing license. The RCGC has the background of what to do with stewards, judging, testing, those little things that don't exist today because there's no live racing, but may be coming to Hampshire in the future. We have an entity who has the opportunity to get a license in Cheshire County. To move ahead and get, not get rid of them, but meld them into another group and suddenly needing them back again, I think would be difficult. So as you look at what we should do, is I look at the world of if there is a casino license and there's casino regulation, it should be separate. Maybe there should be a ombudsman on top, a gambling czar, so to speak, who can, you know, visit objectively, review the activities of those three separate divisions. But we get, I think, not obsessed, but we look at the largest thing, no candles in 50 years, great revenue, super administration skills, but it's restricted in what it can do with its money. How's Charlie going to pick two auditors that have and say, oh, I'm going to charge the casino 8% of this person, or is he going to double the staff? He's going to be stuck having the same duplication. Because he can't use Auditor 1 for the casino and for the lottery, because he's going to have to account for the money. So I think when we look at the lottery and praise it for what it does so well, and then we try to say, okay, give it to the lottery. There's some real issues on how the lottery would be able to deal with it. But I do think that the charitable gaming, it's been incredibly successful, and it's ballooned over the last 5 or 10 years. The previous director had Lucky Sevens and Bingo at the lottery, and he said, they're in direct competition. The bingo players are taking my money on scratch tickets. So you guys get out and go over there. And RCGC has been very good in it. It's a relationship-based regulation. They deal with churches and charities and American Legions and all those different types of small entities. And Jan can just talk for a moment about how important it is to be able to deal with the RCGC.
Good morning. I have been involved in charitable bingo for more than 25 years. I've had the opportunity to have worked with the lottery as well as the commissioners, the New Hampshire Racing and Charitable. I felt the same. I always felt we were in some kind of competition with the lottery. So we were sort of, I don't want to say pushed to the side, but our needs and wants, I don't think were met the way they have been met at the Racing and Charitable Commission. We've developed a working relationship, an open conversation with the commissioners. We've had a couple workshops that are currently working now to improve our rules and regulations to enhance the revenue to the charities. And first and foremost, it's important to have the commissioners involved because they have always had the utmost concern about the charities. It's always their first priority is the charities. And we have a lot of these charities that run the bingo games today. These are their operating expenses. So these budgets are very, very important to these charities today. And I have seen this evolve in the last 25 to 30 years, and it's wonderful, and I can just see the direction we're going now with the commissioners. So I'm going to ask that if I would love to see the commissioners, the staff that's been involved, that we have a relationship now that is directly involved with the new committee that you're looking to form.
And I would also add, I think the statute is a little bit of a presumptive pleading when it says a current divided structure of regulation. It's really a current independent structure. There's no division, there's no competition or antagonism. It's just independent. As I look at it, should a casino be licensed, it's going to need significant staffing of regulatory personnel. And I think it would always have to be somewhat independent because it's going to be in direct competition with Director McIntyre's business. I can see, as I said before, an overview, an ombudsman or somebody who takes that look, but I want to have, I have 36 months to build a racetrack. I want to be able to go to see the Racing Charitable Gaming Commission about where I get my stewards and where I get my testing, as opposed to calling the lottery and saying, where do I get a steward? And they say, what's a steward? So it's not a divided structure. It's an independent structure. And I think we should think first of, will casinos come? And if they do come, what are they going to bring? I don't think they can go to the lottery as is set today. Otherwise, John would have to have the exact same number of people a gaming regulatory commission had. So that's pretty much, I don't want to take more of your time, but I just look at it as not divided, but independent structures.
Okay, I have a question. The current structure. Forget about the casino expansion to casino gaming. It sounds like you think it's a good structure. Am I hearing that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
I have very little knowledge about how charitable gaming works, so forgive me if I sound ignorant. How do you choose the charities that you work with?
Well, that's an interesting question because that is one of the things I think Adam Sifton is proud of. It's a supply and demand situation. 35, 40 years ago, you know, Sacred Heart and Corner of Elm, they have bingo night on Wednesday. Boy Scout would have on Tuesday. They have 50 people, make 50 bucks. Several years ago, maybe a decade ago or so, someone put together a hall and said, you know, let's run it all at one time. So they signed up 5, 6 chairs, then 8 or 10 chairs. And the next guy said, well, geez, I'll have a commercial hall. So it's grown and grown and grown. And the charities apply to the commercial halls for their 10 nights per month. So there's only a certain number of days in the month. and each hall will handle a certain amount of charities. So the charities sometimes are there for years. Jan's had charities for years, but they come and they go. Some charities look to charitable gaming as a real, their own money maker, the way they make the money. Others sell light bulbs. Others have candy drives. So Girl Scouts sell cookies. So each charity chooses where it will go. There's an overabundance of charities who want to get into the game. So it's very busy, and it's very important for the RCGC to license charities who are A, well-run, and B, sincere about it. So the charities, we don't choose the charities, they choose us.
If I just follow up, you said, though, there's an overabundance of charities that want to participate, so there has to be some winnowing out. How do you winnow out, and how is that? How are those decisions made?
I probably can help you with that. Under the bingo operating, you have to create an agreement with, if it be a hall, if you're in a commercial hall, a lease agreement. And you are, under the current statute, you're allowed to have 10 games a month.
Mm-hmm.
They do license them every month. We're under a current, where you have a lease with each charity that comes in there. And basically, at least this, they can stay as long as they'd like. They can give us a 60-day notice if they choose to leave, or for some reason it doesn't work for us, we can give them a 60-day notice too. We currently have a waiting list of approximately about 8 or 9 charities on a waiting list just in case somebody decides to leave. But again, like I stated earlier, most of these charities, these are their operating expenses. It's very lucrative for them, so they continue to stay. It's not a kind of a lease agreement that we have to go back every year and do. Ours is an ongoing lease. We feel as though it's more appropriate for the charities for them to come in and do what they need to do. So as far as bingo goes, it's a long-term relationship opposed to Games of Chance, where they can only operate 10 games a year. But in bingo, they can operate 10 games a month. Mm-hmm. And most of our charities run 2 games a week. Mm-hmm. So we have 5 charities in our hall right now. We run 8 games a week. We do run 2 games on Sunday to try to fit in a little bit more charities that were on the waiting list. So we did add another session to our hall.
Well, you probably also add them because there was some financial incentive for you to add them too, I would think, not just because of. But putting that aside, let me ask you this question. So basically, if I'm hearing you correctly, if you have some, I won't say new charities, but existing charities that didn't get involved in this till, or did not think of getting involved in this until last year or two for some reason, you know, financial, whatever, they're put on a waiting list and are unable to share in the bounty of the charitable gaming unless and until somebody else steps out. Or could you say, we're now going to spread it out. Instead of letting you have 10, we're going to spread this around other folks, and we're going to give you 8 and you wait so we can bring other people in. Can you do that?
I think in some other halls, and I can't speak for them, they do that currently now. They share a couple of different nights with different games.
Mm-hmm.
It tends not to work very well, mm-hmm. because of such the turnover of the volunteers. Remember, we still need volunteers, mm-hmm. to be present on the games. And volunteers come and go. Their schedules come and go. So they tend to keep the certain days of the week. It's easier for them. They're also depending on the charity and what kind of structure they have and what their wants and needs are. They have overhead expenses opposed to maybe just actually donating their money. Like I know some of the charities do. They don't keep any of their revenue. They support other charities that don't currently have bingo now. So bingo does. They do, some of them have the game, but they actually disperse the funds to different charities as well. The Knights of Columbus in our hall, right now, they do not keep any of the funds. They actually disperse that at the end of the year to other charities that do not have bingo games. So there are some charities that do that today.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
April Kate. Or is it Cutter? I may have got the last name wrong. I'm not sure I read it right.
My name is April Kate.
How do you spell that? Just for the.
Pardon?
Could you spell that for the record?
A-B-E-R-I-L-L-C-A-T.
Thank you.
And I work with Vermont Office of Flood Assistance. What I'm in fear of is nonprofits getting squeezed out as time goes on. To keep the commission the way it is set up, which is right where they're doing it right now, Mr. Callahan has stated his thoughts, and that's exactly the way it should be. Keep the two commissions separate, put a commission over them, watch their shoulders and make sure they're doing the right job, where nonprofits have a place to go and complain if they have and be heard. I've heard one commission tell the committee that we have a lot of power down here. I don't see it because you can come in and lobbyists speak, lawyers speak, and that's who the representatives listen to. As nonprofit, I we don't know who to go to. We don't know who the right representative is to go to. So a lot of them do not want to speak because they're afraid they'll lose their nonprofit. I basically deal with Game of Chance, the guy things. And we do not want to lose our turns. And it can be easily taken away from us by the operators if we come down here and we speak out against things that we don't like. The other thing is, we also now pay a rental, advertising, and there's one other one in there. Every day when we have our charity in for our 30, supposedly 35%, but it's down about 33%. I'm afraid we're going to just keep getting squeezed on this. And as the two gentlemen spoke about technology, that is true, because the machines coming in today will take the place of the table games. If a casino comes in, it has to stay with the commission, the Sweet States Commission handling the machinery. No problems with that. Table games are separate. They stay with the commission and the regulators. Nonprofit organizations should get a piece of the table games. We're not looking for anything out of the machines. But when the machines come in, you cannot allow a machine to come in and take the place of a table game. Because eventually, the machinery will take over the whole situation. Because they're all going to be looking for profit. And that's what it comes down to. So I say keep your commissions as is, and then put another commission on top of them to regulate them. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Rick Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to members of the authority. My name is Rick Newman. I'm a lobbyist. I'm here today speaking on behalf of my client, the River Cardroom in Milford, but I've also been involved over the last 19 years. I've worked for parimutuel wagering, charity gaming, represented interest in bingo on Lucky 7, and I'm a licensed primary game operator in the state, a former Games of Chance employer. So I have had a lot of dealings with charity gaming over the years, and my comments here today are going to be brief and focused specifically on current charity gaming under your charge of sustaining charity revenue and looking at current gambling in New Hampshire. And my comments are meant to be exclusive of whatever happens with the casino issue. I mean, I've watched the casino bills come and go, and you know, one of these days the legislature may adopt a law that allows slot machines in some form, whether a mega casino or multiple or what have you. But what I'm looking at is the current, you know, what is available now, what is allowed now, and how to make that better and how to keep that going. So at your first meeting, Director Kelly and Chairman Connors spoke about something that I picked up on that I wholeheartedly agree with, and that is several of the members of this authority were questioning, how do you keep track of the cash in charity gaming? And it's a good question. On poker tournaments at charity gaming, I think you've got a pretty good process of being able to make sure that accounting is, you know, is accurate, and you can, you know, what's owed, because number one, there's a lot of paperwork that goes with the poker tournaments, and there's a lot of eyes on poker tournaments. I mean, if there's $5,000 collected at a poker tournament, trust me, every player in the room knows exactly how much has been collected, how much ought to be distributed. You know, so there's, you've got the sort of accountability in place on the poker tournaments. You know, those of us who are legitimate game operators, and you know, I want to emphasize that, you know, the people that I know in this industry want regulation and want accountability, because we understand that without it, you can't be successful in this business. And so when Chairman Connors and Director Kelly spoke about the table games part of charity gaming as it exists today, you know, that is where I could certainly see that somebody might say, you know, there's not a lot of accountability. How do you keep track of that cash? How can the state know if whether $1,000 came in on the roulette wheel today at the river or whether $5,000 came in? So you're relying, obviously, on the integrity of the game operator, and I have great faith in them that they're giving you an accurate count. I know that I certainly did in the 4 years that I ran a facility in Belmont. I think most, I would certainly have high confidence in most of the game operators in the state. But my comment would be that one of the things they talked about was the ability to use electronic and technology today to enhance accountability. And from a purely, you know, parochial point of view, at the same time that you'd enhance accountability, you'd enhance profits for the charity, the state, and the game operator. The folks from GLI mentioned these electronic table games that are now in the market, and that is a very large growing part of the, you know, what we would call the real casino world. Electronic table games are replacing the traditional table games in a lot of markets, and that market is growing for a number of reasons. As I read our current statute, I don't think there's anything in it that would prohibit charity gaming operators from using those electronic table games. But I also know that the commission has been reluctant to approve them because they don't necessarily think they've got the specific authority. So I would suggest to this authority that as you're looking at drafting legislation, that you consider drafting specific authority to allow the RCGC to approve electronic table games for use in charity gaming facilities. You have immediate 100% accountability. You eliminate errors. The game operators benefit because you don't have the possibility of, you know, collusion between dealers and players or even just honest mistakes. Games are played faster. It's a benefit and a win-win for everybody. So, as I said, I think they probably could be allowed now, but to the extent that the commission has, you know, concerns about that, I think this is something you should look at. And finally, in the Bingo and Lucky 7 world, I also think you should look at allowing technology in Lucky 7s. You know, there's Director Kelly mentioned it to you, that the legislature made a change in the law a few years ago that has been interpreted by the commission differently than I would interpret it, but it seems to me that under the current statute, electronic Lucky 7 devices can be used so long as the commission adopts rules. That's not their view, but as they said to you at their first meeting, they would like to do that, and I completely concur with it. Again, you'd have accountability, you would attract a wider audience, it would benefit charities in the state. And so, again, as you look at, I understand that the gorilla in the room is the casino and slot machines and all that, but I would ask you, as you go forward and perhaps consider drafting legislation, that you consider that sort of smaller part of, no matter what happens to casinos, if you should consider drafting legislation or proposing legislation that would allow for technology to be used in the charity world. It would give a higher confidence level to everybody that you're getting the money you think you should be getting. It would benefit game operators and it would benefit charities. And if I could just end by answering Ms. Sullivan's question about, from the perspective of charity gaming, not bingo, about how do you choose charities? It's an excellent question. And I understand it, and I don't know the basis of your asking it, but I know that a lot of people have questioned it. And the bottom line is, it is a completely subjective, situation. I mean, in the case of the Belmont facility where I was associated with until April, when this law was first passed in 2006, we actually hired somebody to go out and knock on doors to find charities because charities didn't know that you could even do this. So we had to find people in order to be open 7 days a week. Over the years, that, of course, has changed to the point where I think every facility in the state has a waiting list. And so the facilities, I think, tend to do business or continue to re-up with charities they've had before. But a lot of times it's somebody you know. It might be your brother-in-law's on a charity or I've had people just call up and who I know and say, can you get it? Have you got a slot? We've got this charity. And it is a completely subjective manner in choosing the charities. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that's the way it is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Got Dave. Oh boy. WIRJ. Got far enough along to identify you.
Was it Wershing? I couldn't hear you.
Wershing. I guess that's right.
Great.
Could you spell that for everybody?
Sure. Dave. And his last name is Wershing. WIRSHING. And I apologize to the gentleman for my penmanship. It's a couple of issues in the document. Mr. Chairman, good morning, and members of the authority. Thank you very much for the opportunity to give you some of our thoughts today. My name is, as I mentioned, Dave Wershing. I've worked in the gaming industry since 1969. I've held senior executive and ownership positions in casinos in numerous jurisdictions in this country and internationally. For the past 5 years, I've been licensed and an investor with the River Card Room in Milford, which, as you know, is a licensed charity gaming facility here in New Hampshire. I know times are the essence today, and I'll be probably believing some of the things that I was going to say have already been said, so really, I don't know what to be done. If you have any questions at the end, I'm more than happy to take a shot at it. The task that you guys are undertaking that really is probably the key to, in my opinion, to any successful game operation or operations, regulations around the country, around the world, and even the setups that you have certainly vary depending on the complexity and size of the industry, but the one common denominator has to be in the successful jurisdictions is that we have good regulations, competent regulators, and an industry that really respects the authority of those regulators. My mentor told me a long time ago that the three things that are vital importance in the gaming industry. One is that, first and foremost, you have to be honest. And secondly, you have to appear honest, which kind of goes to, I think, Mr. Chairman, your opening remarks talking about integrity. It really is the key to the business. If we don't have that, then the public's not going to have confidence in it, and the whole thing falls apart. And I think from my experience here in New Hampshire, we've got a lot of those things already in place, exactly what the structure should be and going forward. It's something I know that you're going to have to wrestle with, and I know you're going to hire a consultant that's going to help advise you. And there are a lot of good models out there already, as the gentleman from GLI mentioned. I think one of your challenges, from my perspective, and we certainly, you know, obviously have a bias as to what we kind of like to see as gaming moves forward. But it seems to me one of their key tasks is to really be ready for whatever comes. In the field of casino, being the one mega casino, on the border at Rockingham, for example, or the multiple casinos spread out through the state. As you're thinking and developing, I would just encourage you to think of probably, with both of those things in mind, because you just kind of never know where it's going to go. I personally think that, as I said, your planning going forward should include multiple casinos throughout the state. I think the approach that was taken during the last legislative season of the one mega casino certainly is viable. However, I think that the state can benefit to a greater degree if the legislature considers some smaller other casinos in the other regions of it, like the state. They're appropriately sized. I mean, certainly the property at Rockingham could be as big as big. I mean, who knows how big that can be and what it can support. Quite a lot of that is certainly going to be dependent on what happens in Massachusetts. But if you have three or four or five other properties around the state that might have 200 machines, 250 machines, that's going to be very profitable. It can provide lots of jobs. And I think we have a situation where the entire state and citizens have the opportunity to get. And there are an awful lot of examples of that, and you understand the politics better than I, but there are certainly lots of examples around the country where jurisdictions, states, have huge casinos where appropriate, and then smaller properties around the state. Oklahoma is an example of that. While it's Native American gaming, they have one of the largest casinos in the world. That Windstar sitting down on the Texas border takes care of the Dallas market pretty nicely. They're approaching 7,000 machines now. So it's crazy that place is growing. And there's probably about 75 other casinos scattered around the state to various sizes. Some of them have 25 machines in even a filling station, and others have up to a couple of thousand machines if they're in places like Oklahoma City. Or the Tulsa market. I really think that, and it sounds like everybody is on the same page, the charity gaming really needs to be thought of, certainly a complexity for the operators of the casinos as you go forward. But I think the whole charitable gaming road that you've taken is obviously very beneficial to the charities that are involved, and it's beneficial to the state also, because if it wasn't for the contributions of gaming state into the charities, now the state and the taxpayers or somebody else is going to have to pay that for free. We're very, very in favor of a strong regulation. You have to have it. I wouldn't take a step forward without it. And there are people that have been on property. Director Kelly and his group were the people that we've worked with closely over the last 5 years have done a great job. And the learning curve was long for all of us. And it's been a very, I think, a good relationship with the operators, and having worked in jurisdictions where some of those relationships are very, very adversarial, it's pleasant to see people that are interested in helping the industry and not screwing it up. I said I'd be brief. That's about as brief as I can be. I thank you very much for the opportunity to address you this
morning. I appreciate it, too. Any questions? Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Michael Sule. I'm sorry, I have a hard time reading these. Sulecki? Sulecki? Again, if, for the benefit of everybody, if you could spell the name.
Sure. S. Sandler, IELICKI. First with Michael. I'm here today with the Massachusetts Police Association. As the committee knows, historically, we've been opposed to GAMA, expanded GAMA, and prior to that, there was no regulatory structure in place. So we're pleased to see that this committee is moving forward with that to establish that. Some of the concerns that we have had in the past about the regulatory structure is, if you look at the way 152 was written last year, some of our concerns were on the commissions and stuff that were being ahead, were going to be established through that bill. There was really no local control. There was no local police chiefs on any of those commissions. There was no boards of selectmen on those commissions. So that if the communities that were surrounding the casinos were experiencing increases in crime, increases in traffic, increases in welfare assistance that were going to be needed because of potential loss of gambling and stuff like that. There was no place for the local authorities to come and express that. I'm sure they can come to public hearings and stuff like that and express it, but without being on the commission, I don't think that's the same value. So that's where some of our concerns with that. Other concerns the chiefs have, the way that the prior bill was written was the expansion of 106B, 12 and 15. Apparently, there's regulated statutes that say who has jurisdiction in towns to enforce crimes and investigate crimes. So that was some concern for the chief, some of the chiefs. I can tell the commission this, later this month, the New Hampshire chiefs are meeting with the state police and to talk about whether 106 should be expanded or not. To assist in this matter or other matters that you know, the state is facing. So we are in the process of doing that as well. You know, one of the concerns, the real concerns we have is, you have to remember, you know, this is a privately run facility that in which people of the state of New Hampshire have to go to and lose money for them to profit. And that's a concern for law enforcement because that potential loss creates many problems for us, domestic issues, crime, and that's, we need to make sure that that is tightly regulated and controlled. Everybody knows that since the 2006 New Hampshire law enforcement chiefs were opposed to taking enforcement away from the structure we had prior from law enforcement and putting it, you know, that back to the commission. And we can see that that didn't work. That was our concern. Since that time, there's really been little enforcement. And that needs to come back to enforce the laws and to investigate these things. And that's hard because they're short-staffed. And so we need to address that as well through this whole process. And how that is done, that's up to you guys. But I know as chiefs, we'd be willing to sit down and come back as many times as you need us to talk about that and work with you to provide that assistance. Also, the commission, I would like to see as part of the commission is a process for data gathering. So these communities, if there are casinos, one, two, or how many, that there is a process for input from the state welfare agencies, from state mental health agencies, from local law enforcement to keep track of what's going on in the community and what type of increases are happening. And so that there are increase in welfare, there are increase in domestic violence, there are increase in mental health issues, that there's a way to come back to the state or the commission that get additional funding to help these communities that start to suffer when all that stuff takes place or if it takes place. So those are really some of our concerns from the chiefs. Mainly it's you know, come back anytime as often as you need us to work on this and help establish a good regulatory theme for everybody.
That's helpful. I wonder if, I'm not sure I got all the points, and if you have a list or, you know, if you have some written form of what you just said, I'd appreciate having that.
I can give it to you. It just makes a note for that.
That would be helpful. Thank you. Other questions? So thank you. So that we all know where we're at, we have, I've got four slips. I've actually got five slips, but I understand that Mr. Timbers had to leave, or maybe he's back. So I've got four slips, and the next one is Clyde Barron. Our volunteer.
Go ahead and start with the my testimony today. I want to thank the Chairman Ames and members of the Commission for the opportunity to address you today on the question of best practices with respect to regulation. I'm really here primarily to talk about what you might consider going forward if New Hampshire was to actually authorize one or more casinos in the future. So I'm really addressing item three on the list of charges to this commission. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Clyde Barrow. I'm the director of the Center for Policy Analysis at UMass Dartmouth. I'm also the director of the New England Gaming Research Project, the Northeastern Gaming Research Project. We've conducted or supervised over 300 applied policy reports, including numerous reports on the leisure and hospitality sector of the New England economy, which includes tourism, retail, arts and culture, and casino gaming. I've been studying casino gaming and its impact on New England and the Northeast since 1995, and in 2004, we launched the Northeastern Gaming Research Project, which was established to provide policymakers, the general public, and the media with independent and objective research on the economic, fiscal, and social impacts of gaming in the New England and Mid-Atlantic region. In addition to articles published in scholarly journals, the project publishes an annual New England Casino Gaming Update and a biennial New England Gaming Behavior Survey. I regularly follow trends and developments in the gaming industry, publish original academic research on the industry, analyze proposals for expanded gaming, most recently in California, Maine, Massachusetts, Nevada, New Hampshire, Oregon, New York, and Rhode Island. I have been involved in the expanded gaming debate in New Hampshire since 2008, where I previously assisted Green Meadow Golf Club with an economic and fiscal impact analysis of its proposed facility, and more recently as a consultant to Cannery Casinos and Millennium Gaming, which proposed the casino at Rockingham Park. First, I want to give you just a little bit of context very briefly before I start talking about regulatory structures, just to give you a sense of how large this market is. The Northeastern gaming market, which includes the New England and Mid-Atlantic states, has expanded from 28 Class 3 facilities in 2004 to 61 Class 3 gaming facilities in 2013, so more than double over a period of just a decade. This number includes 45 full-fledged casinos and slot machines and table games, and 16 racetrack casinos or slot parlors with video lottery terminals or slot machines. And my testimony, there is a map of those which you can see. Those Class 3 facilities generated approximately $12.6 billion in gross gaming revenues in calendar year 2012 and $15.1 billion in total revenues in 2012, with about $2.5 billion of that being non-gaming revenues from amenities such as hotels, golf courses, spas, retail shopping, and live entertainment venues.
There are currently six gaming venues in New England that account for about $2.9 billion of the total Northeastern gaming market. And as you're well aware, within the next 2 to 3 years, one slot parlor and three resort casinos will open in Massachusetts, with at least one of those facilities likely to open in Northeastern Massachusetts, namely in the greater Boston region. Now, as I mentioned, there are 14 states in what we define as the Northeast region, basically a triangle from Delaware to Ohio to Maine. Those are the states we follow most intensively, although we track developments across the country. Of those 14 states, 12 currently allow some type of Class 3 or Las Vegas-style casino gaming, which one includes Massachusetts. Vermont and New Hampshire are currently the only two of these 14 states that do not allow Class 3 gaming. However, I do want to emphasize that in the context of this gaming market, there are two very distinct models of regulatory oversight, depending on whether a state opts for video lottery terminals or slot machines. And I'll talk a little bit about the difference between the two. The expanded gaming legislation proposed for New Hampshire over the last 5 years has consistently included the authorization of video lottery terminals. There are currently 8 states in the Northeast that allow slot machines and 4 states that have video lottery terminals in their purest form. Those are Rhode Island, West Virginia, Delaware, and New York. And those are the states I'm going to focus on primarily. In 3 of these 4 cases, video lottery terminals are regulated and supervised by the State Lottery Commission, while New York has a State Gaming Commission, but that commission is also responsible for enforcing compacts with 5 Indian casinos. In the 3 states that are most comparable to New Hampshire, the Lottery Commission oversees the traditional lottery, video lottery terminals, virtual and live table games, and charitable gaming. And that would be the case in West Virginia, Rhode Island, and Delaware. And as you can see in Table 1 in my written testimony, there are 3 casinos in Delaware, 5 in West Virginia, and 2 in Rhode Island. So they would be the most comparable to what's being talked about in the state of New Hampshire. Now, to the average casino player, video lottery terminals are similar in appearance to classic slot machines or simulated classic table games. Moreover, as slot machines have evolved from the classic 3-reel mechanical one-armed bandits to 5 or 7-reel push-button electronic gaming devices, the differences in appearance from the customer standpoint are steadily eroding with each new generation of gaming devices. However, there is still one significant difference between VLTs and slot machines, and it is that VLTs are linked together through a centralized computer system maintained by a state regulatory authority, in this case the Lottery Commission, that tracks the gameplay and the earnings for each game. In other words, video lottery terminals have the same appearance as slot machines, but VLTs must receive winning outcomes transmitted by the central system. Now, I'll try to explain this. In a VLT network, all the machines are linked together, whereas a slot machine is independent. A slot machine is programmed to pay out so much independently, it has a chip with a random number generator inside each individual machine, while the gaming devices tied together in a VLT network act as one unit. So, in a traditional Class 3 slot machine, such as the ones used in Nevada or even in Connecticut, a random number generator is programmed onto an internal chip which plays the game with virtual reels that spin conceptually. Those reels can contain hundreds of stops and create millions of combinations, and the results of the virtual game are displayed on the machine's physical reels, and payoffs are distributed across the system instead of by the individual machine. At least that's with VLTs, with the classic slot machine, that's by the individual machine. Now, in contrast, VLTs play a virtual lottery game. In some VLT versions, if I can explain this easily, the machine receives a virtual scratch-off ticket. So one way to sort of imagine this, rather than me sort of doing written testimony, is in the traditional VLT system, the central computer system essentially would have something equivalent to a virtual stack of scratch tickets. When you push a button, it will give you one of those tickets. You don't see that ticket. If you win, what it will do is tell the machine to generate a combination of reels with that payout. So if you get $10, those reels will generate payout. So in other words, the central system is generating the payout, the individual machine generates a combination of reels to give you the appearance of that, so it looks to you like a slot machine, but the payoff is coming from the central system. In the slot machine, traditionally, the individual machine generates that, although these days it's all being done electronically, although visually to the player, it looks the same. There is one hybrid system, Pennsylvania, which we could talk about. It still has electronic slot machines, although it too links those together into a central computer system. The main difference there is that that central computer system has all the same capabilities as a DLP system, except the payouts are determined locally at the individual machine rather than by the central system. So that is a hybrid system that is a possibility, and that's been very effective in Pennsylvania. Now, when you look, however, at the three states that are most comparable to New Hampshire, namely Delaware, Rhode Island, and West Virginia, their regulatory and operating systems are all fairly similar in structure. There is a lottery commission which appoints a director, and the lottery typically reports to the state's chief financial officer. The lottery commission is responsible for licensing VLT operators, establishing VLT regulations and operating standards, employee licensing, licensing gaming and non-gaming vendors, and in fact, in one of the handouts I distributed, I only brought one copy, I provided an actual copy of the regulations in the state of Delaware as something you might want to take a look at. Lottery commission employees under this system are mainly responsible for ensuring revenue compliance, that is, coin in, coin out, cash handling, wire transfers, auditing, and the required distribution of revenues between the state and operator. Although as VLT facilities have added table games, lottery commissions have also assumed responsibility for monitoring and inspecting table games operations and assuring the integrity of table games, and that is the case in the three states that I've discussed in my testimony. Based on other states that have adopted the model proposed in New Hampshire, I might also add that expanded gaming has not produced a behemoth government bureaucracy. In the handouts, I also provided you with organization and staffing charts for Delaware, West Virginia, and Rhode Island. And what you'll see is that the oversight of VLTs in those cases only required the appointment of a new assistant director for VLTs who reports to the lottery director, with a small staff responsible for licensing, administration, and auditing. The addition of table games has required the addition of an assistant director for table games who primarily oversees on-site table games inspectors and their managers. That has involved a bit of a larger increase in staff, but as you can see in the case of Delaware and Rhode Island, which respectively have two and three casinos, Rhode Island having the second largest VLT operation in the country by commercial operators, have 59 and 51 FTE employees, respectively, and that is to supervise the traditional lottery, virtual and live table games, VLTs, and charitable gaming combined in those cases. However, I'll add one other item, which is that there's no question among gaming industry experts that regardless of whether a state adopts a VLT or a slot machine model of expanded gaming, the best practice in regulation and oversight separates enforcement and investigations from licensing and regulation. And Pennsylvania early on had quite a lesson in that particular requirement. Thus, as in most casino jurisdictions, the state police and VLT states maintain a gaming enforcement unit which separates suitability and background checks as well as criminal investigations from licensing and regulation, which is overseen by the Lottery Commission, particularly since the Lottery Commission, as mentioned, is sometimes responsible for marketing and promoting the VLT facility. It's also typical for the Lottery Commission inspectors and state police investigators to have offices on the premises of the VLT facility that are staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with space provided to them by the operator. If Lottery Commission inspectors, casino employees, or customers suspect criminal activity or violations of the Commission's regulations, those complaints are forwarded to the Commission of the Gaming Enforcement Unit of the State Police for investigation. If the State Police Gaming Enforcement Unit finds evidence of wrongdoing, That evidence is typically forwarded to the state attorney general, or in some cases to the local district attorney for the host community for prosecution. So there tends to be a tripartite structure that separates licensing investigation, licensing and regulation from enforcement investigation from actual prosecution, that you have the state police, the attorney general, and the commission all involved in those processes. Now, finally, while we normally talk about taxing casinos, in three states that I've mentioned, that's technically not correct with respect to pure VLT operations, because in those instances, the state actually releases the VLTs and therefore collects 100% of the win generated by the VLTs. The state lottery commission then distributes a share of that revenue as fixed by law to the VLT facility owner and operator, essentially as the equivalent of a lease or rental payment for the use of a private facility. And then it may, in fact, also have contracts with somebody to actually operate and monitor those machines, and they will receive a share to that as a fixed by law. And the remaining revenues are then, of course, transferred to the general fund. But thank you for your attention. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you. Questions? I really thank you for the work you've done here. You've given us a lot to chew on.
Yeah.
I guess I had one question. You talk about the Pennsylvania's hybrid system.
Yeah.
And you said that that's working well for them. Why would that be working well?
It's working well in two respects. One, it's working well in the sense that they've now become the second largest gaming jurisdiction in the country, second only to Nevada. So it has been effective in terms of generating revenues. It's been quite effective in generating jobs since they added a lot of table games. I would say the main thing here is, as I mentioned, that in the case of Pennsylvania, their central computer system is actually more of a monitoring device that says it does not determine the payouts of the machines. Machines make that individual determination with the random number generators. What their central computer system does, however, is monitor the coin in, the coin out to ensure that the revenue is collected properly. It also can monitor the things that the gentleman from GLI talked about. If a machine is open, they know that it's been open, and there have to be records to justify and explain why it was opened or if there's a malfunction. In many cases, the systems are starting to develop pre-diagnostic systems where they can actually tell the probability that a machine is about to break down so that you can ensure that it doesn't break down so it remains in operation. But essentially, their system's been a smooth one. It simply relies on the monitor slot machines rather than VLTs.
All right. Hey, thank you again.
Do you also consult with any gaming authorities or regulators? I mean, because it looks like you work with the industry here a couple of times, I guess. One for the people's Hudson proposal, Cannery Millennium to be at Salem, I think.
We primarily worked with the industry, both commercial and Indian, although we did in 2004 and 2006 consult with the Rhode Island State Senate and the Rhode Island House as an official consultant when they were considering expanded gaming for casino in West Warwick at that time.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Thank you for your testimony. Your suggestion that Pennsylvania had a hard lesson learned, can you describe that?
Sure. Without going into all the details, in the original legislation in Pennsylvania, they actually made their gaming commission responsible for conducting the suitability checks and background checks, as well as issuing the licenses. They got off to a slow start. At the time, that was before Massachusetts, it took them longer than anyone to license the first casino that had ever been done previously. So they were under a lot of pressure to start getting licenses out. The sense was that they overlooked a couple of very egregious cases where they issued licenses in one case to a person with known organized crime ties, in another case to somebody who had actually been convicted of federal financial fraud. It should have turned up, would have turned up probably very clearly if the state police had been responsible to the investigation. They revoked those licenses and subsequently changed the law to remove enforcement and investigation from the commission.
Fair enough. Yes?
Just a few.
You heard the testimony today. There's a lot of discussion about charitable gaming and where that fits. And I just, given your experience, you speak to your charts that we're looking at and where, if possible, charitable gaming would fit in that or should it fit in that?
Well, in the cases that I've talked about today, charitable gaming was under the Lottery Commission, and even in many states that don't have casino gaming for VLTs, it's under the Lottery Commission as well. Typically, it is a separate division. It will have its own assistant director or whatever title that person may have, but it's within that larger umbrella and operates as a separate division.
Yes.
One thing I'm curious about is the differences, or in New Hampshire, do we have more charitable gaming than the states that have expanded gambling, whether it be VLTs or slots through casino gambling? And is New Hampshire unusual in having so much charitable gaming as we seem to have?
On a dollar basis, it probably doesn't have more, although it is very different and unusual in the type of charitable gaming that you will find in most places. You would not, in most states, find the card rooms, essentially, of the sort that have developed in New Hampshire. So in that respect, you're unique in the sense that you already have table games under your charitable gaming law. Most states come at it in the opposite direction, starting with slot machines and then going into table games. If I'm not mistaken, and I call this call correctly, I think there's also a maximum bet limit on the charitable gaming. I think last time I checked, it was $4. In SB 152, when that was last considered, I testified on this to some of the other committees. There was a provision that required the casinos to set aside a certain amount of square footage of gaming space for charitable gaming. What I suggested at the time is that the two were compatible in this respect. Very few commercial casinos are going to offer table games with less than a $10 minimum bet. Sometimes 15 is the minimum bet. So the charitable gaming really occupies a niche sort of beneath where the commercial operators would prefer to operate, and that either involves low-stakes players or beginners who don't feel comfortable risking a larger amount and sort of becomes a feeder market for them, if you will. So I thought there was compatibility between the two in that respect. Might even help charitable gaming in the sense that it's drawing more players to the facility.
In the case of Delaware, did they start with full-blown casinos there, or did they start with casinos or slot parlors?
They started, I think it was in 1994, with slot parlors, VLTs at their racetracks. They added table games in 2010, mainly in response to competition from Pennsylvania.
In West Virginia, what's their
Same exact thing, and almost exactly the same sequence. Like they started in 95 with VLTs and added table games in 2009. And the same with Rhode Island, who just authorized table games started in June.
I think that's it. Thank you. Representative Butinsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to begin by just briefly outlining my biases and expertise. When I was actually in middle school or early high school, my first job was at the Hinsdale Raceway. So I learned about at least gambling there. And however, my professional career before I retired to the house was in fact in addiction. Working to prevent and treat alcohol and other drug problems. So I sort of have both sides of this in terms of my background and experience. What I would like to, I guess, speak to just briefly is the importance of your regulations and looking at the people doing the gambling, and in fact as the representative from the New Hampshire Police Chiefs Association to gather some data. One of the problems right now that I believe we have, unless somebody presents it, is that we really don't know to what extent there is gambling addiction in New Hampshire. I assume there is considerable gambling addiction in New Hampshire with both the lottery, instant ticket sales, as well as simulcast, as well as the poker rooms. As I'm sure most of you know, but some of you may not, in fact, we have in New Hampshire the second largest poker room in New England. I mean, only Foxwoods has a larger poker room than New Hampshire does. We have considerable gaming now going on. And I would speak to, at least my experience with the directors of both lottery and charitable gaming, is that they're outstanding individuals, and I think both of their agencies are doing a great job. At the same time, I don't think they have been told to do follow-ups and collect relevant data. And I'm not sure, frankly, whether it should be those agencies, a new agency, or, for example, the Bureau of Alcohol and Drugs within the Department of Health and Human Services. But we need data on what's going on now, and then we will need additional data if and when there is a casino gambling. Right now, we don't know. I mean, when we have the casino bill before the House, all of the social bills were projected as coming in. Well, some of those may well come in, I'm sure would come in if casino gambling is approved. At the same time, the truth is we have a considerable amount of that now, and we as a state choose to ignore it because we don't track the data, and I think it is an embarrassment and outrageous that we have no data in that area. And I would ask you, as you develop regulations both for the current system as well as the projected system, to begin collecting that data. I know when I would happen to have a tour of that New England's second largest poker room, the director there, actually Mr. Callahan, indicated, in fact, they have self-exclusion policy, whereas, in fact, people can, if they know they have a gambling problem, can say, please don't let me in here in the future. And that facility will honor that. Well, I don't know, and I'm sure Mr. Kelly knows, if that's true of all of the poker rooms in the state. Do they have that self-exclusion policy? They should have that self-exclusion policy if they don't already have it. And you need to look at other things like that to protect people that, in fact, may have or develop an addiction to gambling. At the same time, to speak to the other side of the argument, to try to present a balanced view, the addiction to gambling is relatively small compared to other addictions that we tolerate and maybe even encourage. For example, I think the national data are relatively clear that you have addiction to gambling in terms of pathological gambling or addiction of about 1.5%. However, if you look at alcohol, which certainly New Hampshire benefits from in terms of its sales, alcoholism, comparable to pathological gambling, is in the range of 7%. So comparatively, the addiction to gambling is relatively small compared to other things that we tolerate. And I'm sure the same thing would be true, for example, with regard to nicotine and smoking, in terms of much higher levels of addiction to that. But I do think it's important that you develop regulations so that we can track current problems and any increases in problems, and in fact develop some methods that we can treat individuals or offer treatment at least to individuals that in fact have problems. That's my testimony. I thank you very much. I'd be happy to try to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Is this Representative Lefevre? Mr. Lefevre?
Roland
Lefevre. Oh, Roland Lefevre. Sorry. I'm sorry. Didn't get it right.
Thank you.
still morning, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to apologize to the chair and to the committee for my attire. But being crippled is not only easy to get yourself in the right attire to be where you should be.
Well, we thank you for being here.
But 1973, this is my little legislative Bible. I think you're all familiar with it. But my favorite two articles in here were number 30 and number 31. Perhaps some of you remember what they are. Number 30 and 31. Those are my two favorite articles. So number 30 is freedom of speech. The freedom of speech, of deliberation, speech, and debate in either house of this legislature is so essential to the rights of the people that it cannot be the foundation of any action, complaint, or persecution in any other court or place whatsoever. Now, my second one that I like was number 31, meeting of the legislature. For what purpose? The legislature shall assemble for the readiness of public grievance and for making such laws as the public good may require. Now, public good is a thing that always bothered all of us legislators way in the past. And it still bothers us today. The public good. I cannot see on the scale between right and wrong, or good and bad, what is good for the casino gambling. Can anybody tell me what is good about it? There is none. As Hilda Brungart would say if she was still here, a famous, wonderful woman, take her cane, she did you on the shoulder. Don't tell them, hey, show me what's good. And, but anyway. So I use it. Being brought up on the farm, you learn a lot from the animals. And I don't know how many of you, maybe Representative Hessey is still here, but probably remember the bill for the interstate banking. I fought that bill three times on the floor of the House, and we won. And the time that I relinquished my duty, stayed in my seat, the bill passed. And now we're suffering. We even have to pay to have money in the bank now. And check, my gosh. It's out of this world that they charge you now for a book of checks and so on. So we haven't gained anything with that interstate banking. We've lost. So, for the record, members of this committee, my name is Honorable Roland LaFave, District 2, Ward 6, 19 Dane Street, Nashua, New Hampshire, 03060. My reason for being before this committee is as has always been since 1973. Within this heart, I felt my constituents could be in or on shaky grounds. My oath and obligation must prevail, and proudly did so, except for one time. The third time the vote came before the House was to allow interstate banking. How nice Mr. Dudley and Mrs. Lidcock of Nashua were in securing my loan for building my house in 1952, and how proud I was of our banking system then. We were the envy of Wall Street, Las Vegas. Must not lose our good status we had. On the farm, I fed my pigs on the way to school every morning, walked down the dirt road, crossed the field, whatnot, to get to go for school, threw the grain into the trough,
and the little piggies quickly went quicker than the big one to get to the trough. But the big pig would bite their tails and their ears and squeal off. So Master BP, the big pig, grew fatter and fatter, and the youngest took longer to get to gain weight. One morning, I took my baseball bat, after I fed the pig, I got up on the fence and watched the big pig, till I watched the big pig and I hit the big pig with my bat, with all the strength I have, and broke my bat. At dinner, I told my dad what I did. Well, son, what did you learn? Where not to hit the big pig. The big pig never lifted his head. Right. You could cut off his vitals and he would keep right on eating. That's its nature. I don't know how to tell you this, son, but we have it in the human race as well. The powerful hoarders who never sleep, but dream at night of how to get that last dollar out of you, do. And they don't sleep at night, they just dream of some way to do it. And they can go without food and water, and they can die, and they will die trying to get that last dollar out of you. So if you crack that door, open, tails and ears are going to get bit. Last little card here. The intent. What is the intent of a casino in New Hampshire? They're not going to bring funds from California to build a $1.5 billion hotel and casino. The intent is like Wall Street, principle of control of our banks and the money that we have. They have us for life. The intent is to gradually put New Hampshire into a sales tax and income tax and take control of this tiny little ship sailing freely on the open sea. Big pigs, big boys, can't stand it. We're living too well in New Hampshire, and we love each other too much beyond their wildest dreams. And it shows in this house. We protect each other out of love in this house. My love, may love live in your heart forever to inspire. Thank you, America's best legislators. Thank you very much, Honorable Roland Lafay. But going back again to the intent of this legislation on gambling is not at all for the public good. No one can show me anything about where it's going to help the public. You have the power, and you know you have, to tax whatever you need to do to get the money to hold the state sovereign. Simple. You don't need a casino. And the mothers and fathers and the mothers and children, grandmothers and whatnot, don't need that hassle of watching where hubby's going tonight, gambling or whatever you're going to be doing. They don't need that. That's not going to help them at all. It's like taking the lollipop away from them. And it's not right for the children. And if some of the old legislators were here, they'd tell you the same thing. You've got to protect the rights of the people, not the state. The rights of the people is what counts. And I hope you will do so. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, thank you. And thank you for coming and sharing that with us. Questions? I guess we're all set. Many thanks.
Very welcome.
And that's all I have here in terms of slips. So I think Yes, sir.
I submitted a slip. Did you get it?
We have one more slip.
Sorry.
What's up with the warrants?
I got it. In my absence, I asked the young lady to give the slip because I had to go feed the meat up. I wouldn't want to be in a violation of any of the city or state.
Okay, I believe it's Carl Nolan.
Yes, my name is Carl Nolan. I am a 42-year volunteer to charity. And the reason I say that is I have a 24-hour, 7 days a week job. I have a Down syndrome son. And my charity obviously has to do with children, not only the Down syndrome child that I have, but the children that I chose not to have so that I could go out in the community and take on other young men and women as my own children through baseball, softball, soccer, hockey, high school, acting, anything that I could get involved with to help other children, because I dedicated my life to my child knowing that it would be a long process. But I still wanted to enjoy those other things. So I got involved with charities like American Legion Baseball. I got involved with charities like Youth Hockey. That's not exactly a charity, but it's very costly. And a lot of the events are very costly, and children can't afford it. If you've got children going through these processes, you know that. Even the high schools are starting to charge to play high school sports. So I dedicated what I wanted to dedicate, and I needed to raise money from cookie drives, yard sales, you name it. And then I was fortunate to find out about the Gaming Racing Commission. Charitable gaming. One of the things in all of your processes, whether it be for a casino, to continue the gaming at these poker rooms, whatever you decide, you need to know that all these charitable organizations out there like Kiwanis, Lions, you name those types of organizations, they all have a goal that they're helping the state. They're helping the city. We in the Lions Club, maybe $28,000 to $30,000 a year for eyeglasses and hearing aids that the Health and Human Services can't cover, the federal government can't cover, welfare can't cover. That money comes from Lions, Kiwanis, whatever. And they use the gaming in order to support all of these organizations. I help out with American Legion Baseball for the last, maybe 50 years, either as a player or as a helping participants. And these participants, not all are very rich, not all can afford it. The organization, you say, the Legion can pay for their own, or Babe Ruth Baseball can pay for their own. Well, that's not true, because some of our finer athletes can't afford to even the $100 or the $200 or the $17,000, whatever they're at, they can't afford it. So you need to support those children also. And there are adults out there doing that right now. All of the bills or all of the charity money that we give out, and the three organizations I'm involved with, Association for Retired Citizens, Lions Club of Concord, and American Legion Baseball, every year we distribute roughly $80,000 out of our charitable fundraising. Without fundraising through racing and charitable, we wouldn't be able to do this. In fact, we'd have to fold. So if you stop multiplying all the organizations that are doing what we're doing, and there's no way, the day of cookie sales and light bulbs are over. It just doesn't work. Light bulbs last too long now, so you can't sell them anymore. So they're not going to buy them. So I just want to say that my relationship with the gaming and charitable organizations that help us has been terrific. And they're very well organized, and they know what they're doing, and they're very well supervised by the state. And I know that's the same with the lottery, because I never win, so they must be doing something right. So, you know, they don't build casinos on losers. Yeah, they do, I mean. They only get $20 a year from me, but that's okay. I have other issues. I just want to make sure that you all understand that there are many organizations that are out there to help the community. And through these racing and casinos and whatever it is that helps us make money to support the community, that's what we're there for. But if you pull a rug on me, it won't be there. And then Health and Human Services will be up here asking you for $80,000 to help cows losses. That's it. Any questions?
Questions?
Thank you very
much. I think we're all set. Thank you. Okay, any others? Well, I think we'll call this stage of the public hearing to a close. We do need to talk as a... As a
motion.
Yeah, I do. I need to do it right.
Roll call vote.
Roll call vote. I mean, you know how to do it already. So I recognize Attorney General Foster for a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Gaming Regulatory Oversight Authority go into non-public session pursuant to the provisions of RSA 21I, Code 13-2, and RSA 91-A:3, Roman 2J, for the purpose of considering matters related to the authority's pending request for proposal for certain consultant services issued August 20th, 2013, and request a roll call.
Second.
So the roll call, Joseph Foster?
Aye. Yes.
Charles McIntyre?
Yes.
John Barthelmes?
Yes.
Kathleen Sullivan?
Yes.
Lucy Weber?
Yes.
Patrick Cheatham?
Yes.
Richard Ames? Yes. Senator Rausch is not here. Timothy Connors?
Yes.
Okay. So why don't we take 5 minutes and then...
Are we contemplating, Mr. Chairman, finishing before lunchtime, or?
Yes.
Okay, because I was going to say otherwise, I'd ask you to finish.